Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below.
Okay, welcome to the Embodiment Conference main stage. Tonight we have another treat for you, another treat. Rick Hanton. I was extremely happy when I heard this guy was joining us. Kind of a late addition, but we managed to get him in there. He is, what to say, best-selling author. Senior fellow of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, psychologist, lecture on resilience, meditation, neurodharma, happiness, many other things. Rick, welcome, sir.
Oh, thank you, Mark, and welcome to the topic of embodied well-being in a challenging world. So my hope is to teach from a slide set. I believe you'll get access to the slide set through the links that they'll make available to you and all the rest of it. I feel like I'm participating in about a 28-ring world-class circus distributed simultaneously around the world, orchestrated by these two mad geniuses here, Mark and Steve, you know, to kind of make it all happen. I'm just waiting for a giant tiger, elephant, or bear, Woodstock, or something.
Woodstock is how we think of it. The Woodstock of the...
That's it. I like that. I like that a lot. So anyway, if you want to know more about the background of the materials I'm presenting, I encourage you to check out my website, rickhanson.net. Tons of freely offered resources there. So what I hope to do is to talk through the fundamental process of growing the good inside ourselves, woven into the fabric of our own body, particularly its nervous system and the headquarters of the nervous system, our brain. How do we actually do that? How do we actually grow self-worth, inner peace, healing, release, freedom, grit, gratitude, compassion, skills, and all the rest of it? How do we actually grow that inside ourselves? So I'll present about that, and then which will include some experiential practices. And then I'm going to really try to make time for questions and discussion, which I suspect will come in through the chat sidebar or maybe otherwise. And we'll end at, I'm assuming, 5 o'clock my time, Pacific time, at the top of the hour. Right? Great. Okay, so I'm going to share my screen now, and here we go.
5:02 the hour, if you would, Rick.
5:02 the hour, you got it. So can you enable my screen sharing so I can share my slides?
Sure. Steve.
Okay, great. I'll try not to abuse my co-host privileges. All right, here we go. All right, great. So here's my topic, resilient well-being, hardwired into our brain. In other words, that's actually embodiment. People talk about embodiment as an experience, which is important. And I'm going to explore it in both as an experience and factually, objectively, physically, as what is actually happening inside your own living body as you develop a greater sense of resilience and well-being. What's going on? And how can we promote that process of healing, learning, and growth? That's what I hope to explore with you. So, here we go. To deal with a challenging world, we need psychological resources of various kinds. Know-how, positive mood, secure attachment, executive functions, determination, fortitude, commitment to sobriety, commitment to social justice, and all the rest. How do we get these inner strengths inside ourselves? All right. Well, inner strengths foster resilience, which enables us to deal with the worst day of our lives, but also to thrive every single day of our lives. It helps us continue to pursue our goals and bounce back from adversity. That's resilience. One of the major results of resilience is well-being, because if we're to have lasting well-being in a changing and challenging world, we need to have this inner core of resilience, which I think of as like kind of a keel for a sailboat, so that when the waves hit the sailboat, resilience is what prevents the sailboat from flipping over. And because we have confidence in our keel, we can afford to, as Brené Brown puts it, dare greatly and sail on out to the deep dark blue. Resilience, as much research shows, is grounded in underlying psychological resources of different kinds, inner strengths woven into the living body. These key inner strengths include grit, gratitude, compassion, happiness and positive emotions, self-worth, confidence, a feeling of healthy entitlement that your needs matter too, just like the needs of others, interpersonal skills, emotional intelligence, even spiritual intelligence. These are some of the major inner strengths that help to make us resilient and help to promote a fundamental happiness, inner peace and contentment. The harder a person's life, the more important it is to grow inner strengths. Sometimes people think about the territory of counseling or growth or healing or self-help or spiritual practice as some kind of luxury item. You know, that's for yuppies at yoga camp. And the truth of the matter is, though, the more the world is kicking a person in the teeth, the more a person faces injustice, the more a person is swimming upstream every day just to get through the day, as well as perhaps to put bread on the table or to raise a family, the harder a person's life is, the more important it is to develop inner strengths, right? This is not just for the privileged few. This is actually enormously important for the people who are most mistreated and most let down on this planet, because they're really on their own in terms of this being the essence of self-reliance. Happily, the majority of our inner strengths are acquired. In other words, we can grow them. Roughly about a third of the variation in adults in any kind of characteristic, including gratitude or compassion or self-awareness, about a third of the variation is called heritable. It's baked into our DNA. That means that the other two-thirds, on average, is up for grabs. It's the undiscovered country. It's the result of the way that life, you know, affects us for better or worse, and also the two-thirds of the variation in what we acquire has to do with what we're doing inside ourselves. And this, to me, is both hopeful and it speaks to responsibility. In the innermost temple of our own being, no one can stop us from growing a little, healing a little, and learning a little every day. No one can defeat us in the innermost temple. They may have our body, they may have our White House, but they don't have our innermost being. On the other hand, no one can do the work for us. No one but we can help ourselves heal and learn and grow and awaken even a little bit every day. We earn the fruits of our practice. If we're going to grow more of the good inside ourselves, and as you listen here or watch later, you might ask yourself, what do you wish was more present in your mind these days? A greater sense of ease and patience with a challenging world, more skillfulness with a difficult person in your life, a greater sense of openness, perhaps, to the ultimate nature of reality altogether, whatever it might be. How can you have more of that? Right? Well, to have more of those qualities inside you, in your mood and in your innermost being, that means changing the brain for the better. Or pragmatically, how do we get those green balls in the brain? This brings us to the topic of course, changing the brain for the better. And I want to start here with a parable. This story is told in different cultures in different ways. It has different origins, some maybe with some controversy about the origins of some of them. I'll just tell the story in a simple way. You can judge it on its merits. The way I heard it actually is that a woman was asked toward the end of her life, "Grandmother, how did you become so wise? How did you become so strong, so effective, so happy, so loved? What did you do?" And she paused and reflected, and then she said, "You know, I think it's because when I was young like you, I realized that in my heart were two wolves, one of love and one of hate. And in particular, I realized that everything depended upon which one I fed each day." I've told this story, I can't remember how many times. I love it. It seems so true. It speaks first to the presence of the metaphoric wolf of hate, or really a wolf pack, that's within just about every person. The capacity for aggression, violence, prejudice, even war. And if we hate the wolf of hate, we just feed the wolf of hate. So, and that part of us actually is not to be shunned or exiled. I mean, it has qualities that can help us, but still it's obvious that so much pain and trouble and loss throughout history and in the world today comes from an overactive wolf of hate that can often be stirred up by authoritarian demagogues who play on fears about other people. Also, we have the wolf of love, the wolf pack of compassion, self-worth, friendliness, skillful assertiveness, cherishing other beings, treating others as a thou rather than an it. We have these two qualities. And by extension, we have those things inside us that we want to stop feeding, and we have those things inside us that we'd like to start feeding, we'd like to grow more of, right? That's a fundamental principle. So how do we feed? How do we actually feed and grow the qualities inside us, those different wolves in the wolf pack that we'd like to develop? What's the fundamental how of that process? I'd like to do a little experiential practice with you that will illustrate the fundamental how of changing your brain for the better in its two necessary steps of experiencing something beneficial and then doing things ourselves to really help it leave lasting physical traces behind as durable changes in neural structure or function. So you want to try this experiential practice? You don't have to do it if you don't want to. Like everything I say, adapt it to your own purposes. And if for some reason you don't want to focus on the breath, which can be challenging for some people, especially if there's a trauma history, feel free to get a sense of maybe your room as a whole or something else that you find beneficial and wholesome that you can rest your attention upon. So I'll do this in three breaths. These are three kinds of breaths. It'll take more than probably three breaths for me to get through it. And then later on, you can take more time with this if you like, or do what I do sometimes, just to do three breaths in a row. So first breath, breathing while feeling your chest as a whole. I'll do it with you. Getting a sense of left and right, front and back, top and bottom together, breathing while feeling your chest as a whole. In the second breath, breathing while feeling caring, focusing on the feeling of friendliness, appreciating others, camaraderie, affection, maybe love, perhaps with a hand on your heart or an awareness of your chest area, the area around your heart, breathing while feeling caring. And then in the third breath, breathing while feeling cared about. This might be a little more challenging, keeping it simple, not getting lost in a story about another person, going to the feeling of what's it like yourself to be included with a group of people, or appreciated, or to be liked, to have friendliness, genuine friendliness coming your way? What's it like to receive compassion and support? Even what's it like to be loved in the present or the past? Getting a sense of this, feeling cared about, breathing while feeling cared about. Okay. There actually are strong neuropsychological reasons for doing those three practices. I won't get into that, not in the frame of this presentation, but I just want you to know there's actually research support for why those practices are beneficial and why being able increasingly to just drop into them through acquiring these qualities inside ourselves, increasingly as traits, why that's so helpful to us. But I wanted to use these practices to make a point about the two-stage necessary process of any kind of learning, any kind of lasting healing, any kind of lasting awakening, lasting development, lasting transformation. It occurs in two necessary steps. First, we must experience whatever we want to grow. Right? We begin to feel something in our body. We have a positive attitude. We have a new idea about ourselves or others. We realize, like in my case, how to be a little more skillful the next time you're talking with your wife about COVID or something like that, right? We experience something. We get that song playing in the inner iPod. And then for us to learn from it, for it to leave a lasting physical trace behind, there must be that second necessary stage of learning that in neurology is called consolidation. We're moving from encoding an experience initially to consolidating it as a lasting change of structure or function. We could use the terminology that I do of activation, having experiences, installation, actually internalizing them. This is the movement from state to trait. This process is the foundation of, let's say, becoming more compassionate as a trait over time. We start with experiences of compassion, which we must necessarily internalize. If the experiences just wash on through without leaving a physical trace behind, it may have been momentarily pleasant or useful, but by definition, we didn't become more compassionate as a general quality. Same with gratitude, same with mindfulness, same with anything else we want to develop inside ourselves. We begin by experiencing it, and then enormously important, not to be forgotten, we must internalize it into ourselves. We must come into a kind of a receptive intimacy with our experience so it actually sinks in. This process is summarized in the increasingly well-known saying, neurons that fire together, wire together. Those are the two steps. Firing, together as the physical underlying basis of a useful, beneficial state of being and experience, and then wiring together in lasting physical ways. There are many mechanisms of this process of what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity. Fear not, I will not lecture on all of these. You can have access to this slide, plus I have a lot of references in the back of the slide set if you want. The point is that there are many ways in which our experiences can leave lasting traces behind. Neuroplasticity is not breaking news. Sometimes people act as if they've invented it. It's been understood all the way back to Aristotle that any kind of lasting learning, a kid learning to walk instead of crawl, or an adult learning to be more patient with their own kids, say. I say this as a parent with my wife of two now adult children. Any kind of lasting learning must involve change in the brain. What is breaking news is the extent of it and the number of mechanisms involved in it, and my focus here, how we can take charge ourselves from the inside out of the brain change process, how we can influence ourselves from the inside out, who we are becoming, who we are helping ourselves step by step, bit by bit, grow our way into being. as an illustration of this, and I'll kind of move through this slide fairly quickly, this is a slide that shows the long-term effects of regular meditation, especially mindfulness-based meditation practice. Not that it's better than other meditations, it's just the kind that was studied in this research from Sarah Lazar and her colleagues at Harvard. People who are long-term mindfulness meditation practitioners, and I know some of the people in the study, they weren't perfect meditators, but they were pretty consistent. They had measurably thicker brains, thicker cortex, in three key regions compared to matched non-meditators, matched in terms of age, gender, socioeconomic status, and so forth. Three key regions were, one, the insula on the inside of the temporal lobes, a part of the brain that tunes into experiences. So as these meditators kept working that muscle of repeatedly coming back to the sensations of breathing, their own gut feelings, the internal world of their own being, they were working that muscle. They were getting those neurons to fire together repeatedly, so they began to wire together as well. Second, right behind the forehead, prefrontal regions that are involved in the executive control of attention, the top-down regulation of attention, bringing, you know, the wandering attention back to the sensations of breathing, or right now coming back to what in the world I'm talking about here if your mind starts to wander off. And they work that particular muscle again and again and again and built up structure there. Also, these meditators got a bonus benefit in somatosensory cortex at the top of their forehead because they were tuning into their body sensations. This is evidence of lasting change. And this kind of evidence shown in neuroimaging studies on the actual brain of physical changes in the brain has been supported by other kinds of studies about many other kinds of meditation and also many other kinds of deliberate mental practices, such as cultivating kindness and compassion or going through psychotherapy, let's say. A point I want to make at the very bottom in the scatter plots are called with the red dots and the red squares and the blue dots is that normally we lose probably a few thousand at least brain cells a day. We start with 85 billion neurons and another 100 billion or so support cells, so a few thousand a day offset by growing a few hundred a day, new baby neurons. That's not too bad. But that process in the cortex called normal cortical thinning due to aging is associated with normal cognitive decline, not dementia, not Alzheimer's, but walking into a room and forgetting why you walked into the room. Or, where are my keys? Or, what's that word again, right? Check it out. Check out the scatter plot. The older red square non-meditators had measurably thinner cortex in those three key areas compared to the blue circle meditators who were younger, and also compared to the red square non-meditators who were younger. Normal cortical thinning associated with normal cortical decline. But the older blue circle meditators, and I have a hunch that there are a fair number of you participating in this amazing program, the older blue circle meditators had just as thick cortex in these three key regions as the younger meditators and the younger non-meditators. They used it so they did not lose it, which has lots of implications for everybody, including an aging population. So I'm putting up this slide here, not so much to persuade you to meditation, although I think it's a pretty good thing. I've been doing it since 1974, but to make a larger point that what we practice deliberately can grow stronger based on measurable physical changes inside our own body in a truly embodied kind of change. This means that every day we have opportunities, a bit at a time, a moment at a time, a breath at a time, to help ourselves have beneficial experiences or simply to notice the ones we're already having and then turn on the inner recorder, a breath at a time, a moment at a time, to really help them sink in so that over time we truly do become wiser and stronger, happier and more loving. But here's a key point. Experiencing alone does not equal learning. Just because we're having a good insight or a good intention or a good feeling doesn't mean it will shift us in any kind of lasting way. This is the dirty little secret in my profession of psychotherapy and related professions of coaching, mindfulness training, compassion training, and so forth, parenting as well. It's great to have beneficial experiences, but how many of them? It's haunting and humbling. How many of the useful ideas, feelings, intentions, body sensations, experiences that we have, how many of them are we actually shifted by? How many of them leave lasting residues inside us so that as a result, we develop traits of happiness and self-worth, skillfulness and resilience, for example? I think that where the great opportunity is in any and all of the helping professions, really broadly, and certainly in any kind of people who work with others, supervising others, educating others, raising others, the great opportunity, I think, is not so much to try to foster shinier, newer, cooler experiences, but to get better at installation, get better at internalization, get better at actually influencing lasting changes in the physical body. And now I want to talk with you about how to do that. This focus on activation, but not on installation, this focus on having experiences, you'll find it routinely. People will talk about neat experiences. Okay, great. How are you helping me absorb them into myself so they become part of me? So that forever after, I'm a little bit more this way. That's the crux of the matter. And without that focus, the gains from psychotherapy, coaching, and all the rest are flatter than they need to be, especially for those people who don't seem to get much out of it. This larger point, by the way, about the ways in which we routinely leave all that money on the table, we routinely let beneficial experiences wash through our brain like water through a sieve, which flattens our rate of healing and growing and awakening from the experiences we're having. This point is sharpened by what scientists call the negativity bias, the result of having a Stone Age brain in the 21st century. Our brain has been evolving, or the nervous system has been evolving for around 600 million years in terms of biological evolution. And during that long road, that long, 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 long road, it was critically important for those who survived to pass on genes that passed on genes, to really learn from any encounter with sticks, knowing that if they didn't get a carrot today, they'd probably have a chance at one tomorrow. So we have a brain, literally, right now, and we can all be aware of the ways in which this plays out. And by the way, they have a similar brain too, right? Other people do, that scans for bad news, over-focuses upon it, overreacts to it. We react more to pain than to pleasure, more to loss than to gain, over-remembers it. Much research shows, for example, that a single negative interaction in a relationship has much more lasting impact than a positive interaction. That's why there needs to be a lot more positive interactions as they are experienced by the other person compared to the negative ones experienced by them, just to kind of keep it even, right? Have stressful, upsetting, irritating, sad, anxiety-provoking experiences, that gradually sensitizes the brain to the negative, because cortisol, which is released when we're irritated or frustrated or blue or lonely, goes up into the brain, and in the brain, it sensitizes the amygdala. Cortisol does. So now the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, rings more loudly and more readily, while meanwhile, cortisol weakens and eventually can kill neurons in the hippocampus, a nearby part of the brain that calms down the alarm bell. It inhibits the amygdala. The hippocampus can put things in context and help us understand that our boss is not our father or our mother, even though sometimes they seem like it. They're not really that. And the hippocampus tells the hypothalamus, another key part of the brain, got enough stress hormones already, don't need any more, enough, right? So if we weaken the hippocampus while sensitizing the amygdala, that creates a vicious cycle, because that happening today makes us just a little more vulnerable to stressful negative experiences tomorrow, which sensitizes our brain further, which makes us even more vulnerable to them the day after that, in a vicious cycle. And this general process of the negativity bias also creates vicious cycles out in the world, because as we feel increasingly burdened or sad or frustrated or helplessly outraged, et cetera, then we act in various ways that tend to create more negative experiences for us, which then sensitizes us further. It's a reality. The negativity bias is designed to help us. It's useful sometimes. It's useful, let's say, if you're working in a combat zone, or it's like you're growing up in a combat zone. But for most people, the negativity bias creates much excess suffering and much excess conflicts with other people. Mother Nature's well-intended plan, thanks, Mom, thanks, Mother Nature, her well-intended plan is to give us a brain that's like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones. In effect, we've got a brain that's very good at learning, at being changed by bad experiences, but relatively bad at learning from good experiences, even though learning from good experiences of inner strengths, such as gratitude and self-worth and feeling loved, even though learning from good experiences of inner strengths is how to grow them and hardwire them into your own nervous system so that you have them with every day, have them with you for every day. Okay, what can we do about this? What can we do to promote lasting embodied growth and learning and development in whatever ways we want? And second, what can we do to compensate for the ways in which Mother Nature has tilted the playing field against us in terms of the negativity bias, just to level the playing field? That takes us to the topic of what I call self-directed embodied learning, which really means self-directed neuroplasticity. This process is simple. It's in the moment. It's with the experiences that we're actually having. It's well summarized in this proverb: think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good. In other words, in terms of the ordinary, authentic, everyday experiences we're already having, feeling a little reassured, feeling a little delighted, feeling a little calm, feeling a little loved, whatever it might be, that's a drop. And then we can slow it down and help it land in the water pot so we increasingly gather it inside ourselves. A little more technically, I've developed this framework called the HEAL process, whereby we turn states into traits. We literally engage factors inside ourselves that increase neuroplastic conversion from experiences to lasting physical changes in our brain. This process is summarized with the acronym HEAL, H-E-A-L. It speaks to the two stages of any kind of lasting growth, any kind of lasting learning. First, we begin by having a useful experience, and then we internalize it, we install it, we hardwire it into the living body by enriching it, helping it be big and last, and by absorbing it into ourselves. And then potentially, optionally, if we want, we can associate positive to negative. And in so doing, we can link them, linking a big positive experience to a feeling maybe off to the side that the positive experience is the natural antidote for. So I'm going to show you some pictures about this. Step one, have a beneficial experience, usually because it's already happening. You know, I had a nice little moment of kind of banter and joking around with Steve and Mark when we started here, and I liked that experience. It was like simple friendliness. It was not more than what it was, but it was not less than what it was. Right there, it's already happening, and I could notice it. Or alternately, a person could deliberately create an experience. They could deliberately mobilize a sense of mindfulness. Or they could deliberately mobilize, as I say this as a longtime rock climber, the feeling of pulling over the overhang, being really determined. They could mobilize and create that sense in the body in order to kind of strengthen themselves to deal with some kind of adversary. Either way, noticing or creating, we've got that green ball there, right? We're having a beneficial experience of one kind or another. And then if we want to learn from it, we can pop open the bottleneck and enrich the experience by staying with it for a breath or longer. The longer those neurons are firing together, the more they're going to wire together. We can help it become more intense. We can feel it in the body. We can be aware of what's fresh or novel about it. We can be aware of what's personally meaningful about it. Any one of these things can increase internalization, but the more the better. And we can absorb it. We can get a sense of receiving this experience into ourselves so it becomes part of us in really, really lasting ways. Optionally, and then I'll get to that in a second, but I'll just say it like this, it's like a fire. You know, first, have fire. Have fire, right? Notice one that's burning or light a fire. And then second, enrich it. Protect it. Don't let other people rain on the parade. Don't let yourself jump onto the next thing. Routinely, we're having one useful, beneficial, pleasant, enjoyable experience after another, but we don't stay with them long enough so that they can sift down into long-term storage. Stay with the fire, right? That's enriching. And then absorb the warmth of the fire into you. This is the fundamental process. Optionally, if we want, we can be aware of a positive experience in the foreground of awareness, like feeling cared about and loved and valued today, while off to the side maybe are old feelings of being unwanted, left behind, cast out, shamed, devalued. And so with repetition, as we're aware of both of these at the same time, the positive associates with the negative and eases, soothes, and even potentially replaces it. This is the fundamental process. Now, it may sound kind of complex, and in my books and writings, I talk about the details of this and how to apply it to different particular situations, but the essence is really simple. Have it, enjoy it, right? Have that beneficial experience, and then kind of marinate in it for a breath. You're not clinging to it. This is a very important point. As we internalize these green balls, as we internalize the felt sense of feeling safe enough and satisfied enough and connected enough, for example, the basis for craving, the basis for resisting or grasping or clinging falls away because we feel already content, already loved, already calm and strong and whole, all right? So it's paradoxical, but cultivation, internalization actually undoes craving. As we internalize, for example, a growing sense of our own personal worth, we become less hungry for social supplies, sometimes called narcissistic supplies, outside ourselves. I think people sometimes have this notion that they need to push away beneficial experiences, like, oh, I'm going to want them. Well, if you actually internalize them, truly internalize them, you're not going to want them so much because you're going to have that mood or that feeling with you, or that sense of others, including inner allies, with you wherever you go. Do you want to try it? Brief experiential practice here. So if you want, you don't have to do it. Let's do this twice. So in the prompts here, I'm going to suggest ways to create an experience, but once you're having it, it's a real experience, and then you can genuinely internalize it. So how about bringing to mind one or more things that you're thankful for? And help the idea of what you're grateful for become a feeling of gratitude. Could be other people, could be good fortune, blessings you've received. There might be a sense of the gifts of nature, the ocean, being alive at all. And then stay with it. It's like a micro meditation in which gratitude is the object of attention. You might have a sense of your body softening to receive and absorb a growing sense of gratitude. Good. The brain is really fast. Neurons are firing 5 to 50 times a second. A lot can happen in a breath or two or three. So let's try this now with a sense of calm strength. You can bring to mind time in your life that you were really determined, maybe doing something physical, maybe sticking up for somebody else or even yourself. See if you can get a sense also of an underlying calm, the feeling of calm strength. Maybe a sense of calm strength on your own behalf, being for yourself. Being on your own side. Letting this land and sink in. What do you like about the feeling of calm strength? What's enjoyable or meaningful about it? Okay. By the way, the last suggestion I gave to focus on what feels rewarding about an experience and highlight what's rewarding about it is, as with all my other suggestions, even though I don't always explain them, it's neurologically informed. In other words, as we highlight the sense of reward, our brain becomes more receptive to the experiences we're having at the time. Technically, the activity of dopamine and norepinephrine, two neurochemicals, increases inside the hippocampus when we're focusing on the sense of reward. And as activity of those neurochemicals increases, the experiences we're having at the time are flagged as important ones. They're flagged for protection and prioritization as they get slowly consolidated physically and bodily in the long-term storage over the next hours and days and even weeks. Happiness, in a lot of ways, is skillful means. So stepping back here, this fundamental process of growth is what I'm focusing on here. And it's really interesting that people who are in the growth business, you know, therapy, counseling, training, spiritual teaching and all the rest of it, it's really interesting that we don't tend to focus on actually how growth happens. It's like it's a mystery. You know, if you just start throw enough mud on the walls, people will somehow heal and grow and transform. Something will sink in. And it does tend to for maybe a quarter or a third of the population. But a lot of research shows that roughly a third to two-thirds of the people who do anything don't get much out of it. Or if they get something out of it for a little while, the gains fade very, very quickly. Isn't it? It's really a missing piece, this lack of focus on how growing happens, hardwired into our body, and how we can become active agents in that growth process, thereby steepening our own learning or growth curves every day. Milarepa, the great Tibetan sage over 1,000 years ago, talked about his own process of transformation over the course of his lifespan. And we can apply that to our lifespan or to anything in particular. He says, in the beginning, nothing came. He couldn't experience it. He couldn't feel calmer. He couldn't feel stronger. He couldn't feel more grateful or whatever. Just couldn't do it. It's like lighting a fire with wet wood. But then over time, in the middle, he was able to experience these things, but they didn't stay. They were states, but they were not yet traits. They were not yet acquired or and woven into his very being. But by the end, nothing left. His inner peace, his strength, his enlightenment, was stable. It was present. It was durable. It was with him wherever he went. This is the process. And I think it's really helpful. In the beginning, if we can't experience something, we try and we work at it, and eventually we can get something going. In the middle, as we're experiencing these things, we can then help ourselves learn from them. And then by the end, yes, these qualities are in our mood. They're in our attitude, our whole approach to life. And even if we get a little rattled, we recover much, much, much more quickly. As we grow in these ways ourselves, we tend to create positive processes out there in the world altogether. In the proverb attributed to Lao Tzu in the Chinese tradition, if we keep a green bough in our heart as we grow and develop in these ways, a singing bird will come. In other words, people tend to treat us better, not perfectly. I can tell you that from some experience, but you know, pretty good odds. We become more skillful in how we deal with the world, and then we're able to be more effective in the world. We're able to have stronger, better relationships, to some extent at least. And then as that happens, we have more beneficial experiences, which in turn we can internalize into ourselves. That's really, really good. Learning is the strength of strengths. If you think about it, it's the superpower of superpowers. I say as a guy who read a lot of comic books about superheroes when he was younger, because learning is the strength that grows other strengths. Therefore, learning how to learn in the broadest sense, not book learning, that's the least of it, social, emotional, somatic, motivational, even spiritual learning, as we actually learn how to help ourselves grow a little every day, we can apply that to anything. We want to heal and develop and transform inside ourselves. Therefore, I think that learning how to learn is the most important learning of all. As I approach an end here in the next few minutes, I want to highlight two key points. The first is that we can use these general methods of self-directed neuroplasticity to grow particular psychological resources inside, particular qualities inside ourselves, particular attitudes, emotions, moods, and so forth. And we might ask ourselves, for ourselves or maybe someone we care about, what if it were more present in their mind these days? If it were more accessible to them? If it were more the habit of their heart? Or if it were more the habit of my own heart, let's say, would really help, particularly given the challenges one is facing. This is a way to identify what a key resource, a key inner strength is. And then second, how could a person have more experiences of that inner resource and then, critically important, internalize those experiences and really to produce lasting embodied change in literally their physical body? This little model here that I'm showing you is a framework I've developed, and you can find it in my work, as a way of identifying the particular inner strengths that would make a big difference for a person. For example, to help ourselves in terms of our needs for safety, you know, you can see here that it's useful to be able to assess threats accurately, not overestimating them or underestimating them, and to develop a growing sense of inner peace. It can be really important to find the strengths that matter for you. When I was a kid, I wasn't traumatized, but I was really unhappy. I was very young going through school, skipped a grade, and I have a late birthday, and I felt very lonely and left out and unwanted and unseen. And my parents, while being very loving and decent, really wonderful, good people, no longer alive, were poor at empathy. So I did not have much sense of actually being seen as a being. This left me, by the time I went off to college at 16, with what felt like an enormous hole in my heart. And I tried to fill that hole by partying and having a great time in college in the 70s, late 60s, but that didn't address the hole in my heart. In other words, I fulfilled my needs for satisfaction, but my needs were in the field of connection. I also tried to be tough, determined, you know, armored, bunkered up, but that might have helped me deal with my need for safety, but it didn't address my need for connection. It was as if I had scurvy and I was trying to solve that problem by taking iron pills or B vitamins. No, I needed vitamin C. And it's when I started to actually focus on in college and then later, noticing the facts of when I was actually happening today what had been missing when I was a kid. I started to notice when I was being included or befriended, and then help myself feel something, not just notice the facts, but feel something, and then internalize it. That's when I started to genuinely fill that hole in my heart, drop by drop, or as they say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. So here's a question for you, or anyone you care about or are working with. What's your vitamin C? What would make a big difference if it were more present in your mind these days? Maybe you can find an answer to this question by listening to the longings in your heart and not brushing them aside and letting your longings be your teacher. Maybe you can identify your vitamin C by asking yourself what would have made a lot of difference to have experienced back then, or would make a lot of difference these days. However you do it, it's really useful to know what you're trying to grow these days and then look for opportunities every day to develop more of it inside you. Second key point has to do with some wider implications. As I've reviewed here, as we grow inner resources, and every day gives us opportunities to go to bed a little wiser, a little stronger, a little happier, a little more loving than we were when we woke up in the morning. As we grow these inner resources, these inner strengths, we become more able to cope with hard stuff, with loss, with stress, recover from trauma, and keep on going, pursuing our aims. At the individual level, this is the essence of self-reliance. This is the essence of helping ourselves down the long and twisty road of life. And at the level of groups and countries, I speak as someone living in California, in America, in the midst of a very, very consequential election right now. As people build up these inner strengths inside of calm strength, contentment and gratitude, and a sense of worth and compassion for others, including their adversaries, as people grow the good inside themselves, as they develop more and more of what I call a green zone brain, they become a lot harder to manipulate in the classic ways we've seen throughout history and we see in the world today, including in my own country. They become a lot harder to manipulate with, you know, the appeals to fear and anger in terms of safety, greed and possessiveness in terms of satisfaction, and us against them, you know, conflicts with other people, which has enormous implications for the whole human tribe as we enter the 21st century. You know, and my fond hope is that somehow, as individuals both improve the world, which is really important to do, it's not either or, improve the world around us, while also internalizing the good that is available to experience authentically, without rose-colored glasses, that as more and more people do that and take care of every little monkey among us, that will help our whole planet come to a much softer landing by the end of the century than the one it's currently headed toward. So thank you very much. Thank you for your attention and thank you for your practice. And I'm going to stop sharing my slides now and see if there's a comment or question that we have time for.
Thank you. Super elegant, straightforward, practical, helpful, and it's felt like delivered with huge friendliness and love, which I appreciate. Mm. I think sitting thank on you. The couch, cheeseburgers, listening and enjoying. So thank you. Can I read out a question for you here?
Please.
Do you have any techniques to handle something that unexpectedly occurs that triggers memories of a past trauma? And that's from Tony.
Oh, sure. So a lot I could say, and you know, so let's suppose something, it arises, there it is. First and foremost, first thing of all, is to be mindful of it. Be aware of it with mindful, spacious awareness. There's a traditional metaphor that pain in effect is like salt. If you put a teaspoon of salt in a cup, stir it up and drink it, it tastes horrible. But if you take the same amount of salt, the same amount of pain, the same amount of horribleness, and you put it in a big bucket of clean water, which is like the field of spacious awareness, witnessing the experience, not fighting it, witnessing it, being with it, but not being overwhelmed by it, not being hijacked by it or identified with it, that field is like a lot of water. And then you stir it up and drink it, it's not so horrible. That's step one. Second, I think there's a natural movement from being with the experience, which is the primary practice, at some point, it often is appropriate to deliberately shift into working with it. And there are two ways to work with experiences. The first is to release what's negative. And I'm using that term loosely. What is painful? What is harmful? What is unwholesome? What is unskillful? To release it, to let it go, to let it flow. And third, the other aspect of working with your own mind is to grow the good, to develop more positive qualities inside ourselves. If our mind is like a garden, we can witness it, pull weeds, and plant flowers. I focus on planting flowers because it's the forgotten stepchild in spiritual practice and in psychology, and very important, but it's in this larger context. So specifically, what a person could do is recognize they've gotten triggered again, feel it, be with it, step back from it, move into some sense of letting go while bringing in resources like self-compassion. Self-compassion. You know, resources like reminding oneself that that was then, this is now. Resources like whatever happened back then, there are things these days that are good, that are the opposite. There are people who are trustworthy. There are people who do love you. There are things even back then, maybe you were understandably helpless. You were small, you were little, you were overwhelmed, you were outnumbered. You know, but these days there are ways that you can be more like a hammer and less like a nail. You do have more influence over yourself and over your life, and you can be aware of that. So these are examples of different resources that are antidotes to traumatic material, including as a common feature of trauma is a sense of failed protectors. People who should have stood up for you, should have seen what was happening, should have come through for you. And so if that's part of in the trauma picture, something that's a matched current resource today is a sense of allies, both outside you and inside you, always based on what's true and what's real.
Thank you, Rick.
That's my take.
Wish we had another hour as always, but this was super good. Much appreciate your time, Rick. Really appreciate it. We'll come back to you for a final closing comment. Thank you for everyone who was on the screen here. I know it's so much easier with an audience for a presenter, so thank you. If you want to do a breakout room afterwards, you can say hello to some other human beings and talk through some of the things we've been looking at here. The breakout rooms are just that nice human function of connection rather than sort of, you know, one way. The Facebook group remains relatively civilized and pleasant for social media. So feel free to come and chat there and, you know, start topics if there's things of interest. The library of recordings is half price until after the conference. We are ending in 2 days. Oh my God. So there's lots before then. For example, tomorrow, Max Strom, you may like. Very practical breath work. Judith Blackstone's got a very unique approach to meditation. Stephen Porges, I'm sure many of you know. Gil Headley and A.H. Almas in the evening, just to name just a few over the next 24 hours. So plenty on. The talks continue through the day and night, every 2 hours, no matter where you are. And yeah, if you get the library, you can just digest it in your own time now. Feeling like you've got to force feed yourself all the sessions. And it really helps us out. We haven't quite reached break-even point yet, and I'll certainly be a lot more relaxed when we do. So thank you to us as well as a treat for yourself if you can get that. Okay, Steve, my late night date is our last late night date. It's been a pleasure, sir. Anything you want to add there?
No, yeah, I'm looking forward to the rest of the conference. There's still some really awesome stuff to go, so don't check out and miss it. And thank you, and thanks, Rick.
Can we give Steve some love? Because he's just always in a positive mood that really impacts well on the whole team. So that's a huge gift, huge gift.
That's great.
Okay, so we are putting a book together, Rick, with a one-sentence quote from all 1,000 presenters. So what is your top tip for the book?
Deal with the bad and turn to the good and take in the good every day.
Beautiful. I really, really enjoyed this one. So, and much needed too, the negativity bias one. I was like, oh yeah, don't listen to that.
Well, if I could add, keep on rocking in the free world. Do not underestimate the power of personal moxie that says whatever's going on out there, got to deal with it as best we can. But in here, preserve that inner freedom. Bad enough that they've invaded your country or your government, don't let them invade and remain inside your own mind.